Hello everyone, my name is Francis Donald and I'd like to welcome you to this 13th session in an ongoing series of webinars on sacred number and geometry. If you'd like to view any or all of the first 12 sessions, they are available on makara.us. If you have any questions about your interface, the GoToMeeting interface, feel free to text BL in this in the middle of your control panel there. You'll see the window depicted here. And just type in if you have are having any problems or anything. BL can fix any problems, and if she can't, Brett, who is also standing by, will be able to assist. Okay. During our last session, we analyzed the five-pointed star and looked at the potent role it plays in the initiation process. We considered the idea that the fifth initiation, that at the fifth initiation, the candidate becomes the five-pointed star. This event of becoming the five-pointed star that the fifth initiate undergoes represents the final perfection of a human being, and that's achieved through the total identification with that vibrant something, as DK calls it, that lies behind a symbol, in this case the five-pointed star. This is a real game changer in terms of our understanding of symbols and helps us to begin to comprehend DK's words: symbols are the outer and visible forms of the inner spiritual realities. And when facility in discovering the reality behind any specific form has been gained, that very fact will indicate the awakening of the intuition. I'm going to be using a few DK quotes here in the very beginning. So I'd like to have a volunteer reader for this first section that describes what happens as a result of the study of symbols. Could we get a volunteer?
Hands up, please.
Anyone, you won't be tested. Or if you are, we have a very low pass.
There we go.
System. Okay. Great.
Go ahead, please, Anne.
And Veronica, hello, can you hear me?
Hi, yes.
Yes. The study of symbols, when carried out with faithfulness and diligence, will produce three effects. It trains in the power to penetrate behind the form and to arrive at the subject reality. Second, it tends to bring out about a close integration between soul, mind, brain, and when that is brought about, the inflow of the intuition and consequently of illumination and truth becomes more rapidly possible. Three, it will put a strain upon certain awakened areas in the brain and arouse into activity the brain cells there found, and this is the first stage in the experience of the aspirant. Glamour, a world problem.
Thank you. He later mentions that the brain cells most stimulated by the contemplation of symbols are those associated with the pineal gland. And one more DK quote. Let's get another reader for this. Oh, gosh, all kinds of problems today. Here we go. Wait a minute. There we go. So another volunteer for this.
Okay.
DK quote.
Please. Tanya, we're getting some really bad feedback. I'm going to go to somebody else, okay, Tanya? I'm sorry. But now I just need another. There we go. Thank you. Okay, Scott.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Hi, Scott.
Good. This power to interpret symbols ever precedes true revelation. Only using the activity and accuracy of the memory will do not to awaken the dormant brain cells or call into play the intuition. It must be remembered that the plane whereon the intuition manifests and where the intuitional state of consciousness is active is that of the buddhic or intuitional plane. This plane is the higher correspondence of the astral or emotional plane, the plane of sensitive awareness through a felt identification with the object of attention or attraction. It becomes evident, therefore, that if the intuitional faculty is to be brought into activity through the study of symbols, the student must feel with or be in some way identified with the qualitative nature of the symbol, with the nature of that reality which the symbolic form veils.
Thanks, Scott. So this is why in our three-part analysis of symbols, DK stresses both meaning and significance, with significance defined as pertaining specifically to a stimulation of our emotions and our emotional bodies. We have to feel it, folks. We have to experience the polarity of the square and the unity expressed in the equilateral triangle if we are to stimulate our intuitions. Okay. Before we consider the golden mean, which will be our main topic today, I'd like to follow up on last month's discussion with just a bit of history about the five-pointed star. Here are some examples of its appearance in the fourth millennium BC. One of the earliest uses of the five-pointed star in the archaeological record was in Mesopotamia. At least as early as 3500 BC, the pentagram was used to decorate pots and was found in cuneiform writing proclaiming royal authority over the four corners of the world and the heavens above. So it was immediately important. The entire archaeological record shows the importance of this symbol. It also appears in Egyptian hieroglyphics representing the cycle of Venus from morning to evening star, and was the symbol of the goddess Sopdet, an embodiment of the star Sirius. So association of the five-pointed star with Venus and Sirius suggests that the ancient Egyptians recognized the monastic implications of this symbol. Of course, we know this to be true from the heritage of Hermes Trismegistus, who was an exemplar of the monastic principle. The Pythagoreans called the pentagram Hugia, with the combined meaning of health, wholeness, and blessings. Not Hygieia, which was the goddess of health, but this more comprehensive entity called Hugia. The letters of this word, Hugia, were placed around the points of the pentagram. According to Iamblichus, who's there on the left, who we're told in the book Light on the Path was an incarnation of the Master Hilarion, the five-pointed star was the Pythagorean sign of recognition and held sacred by them as a symbol of divine protection, perfection. Probably protection as well. Possibly this is why it was made the symbol of their great brotherhood. This is no great surprise, since Pythagoras is generally recognized as a master of wisdom. He would have himself become a five-pointed star. That is, he would have fully identified with the life that expresses itself through that symbol. To the ancient Hebrews, the pentagram was a symbol of truth and also of the five books of the Pentateuch. In the Arthurian legends, the legend of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the pentagram was emblazoned in gold on Gawain's shield, representing the five virtues of generosity, courtesy, chastity, chivalry, and piety. Remember Gawain? He was a knight that recognized Dame Ragnell's sovereignty, thus transcending the either-or duality. Okay, The symbol of the pentagram is intrinsic to the architecture and the location of many French churches. For example, the mysterious shrine of Reine du Chart, said to be a center of Templar activity, is situated in such a way that it became part of two pentagrams. This is a fabulous and mysterious story, by the way, and if you're interested in the shrine or in the Templars, I strongly recommend the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail. I'm sure many of you have already read it. It's a particularly great read. Albert Pike called the five-rayed blazing star, a Masonic symbol representing Sirius, the guardian and guide of souls. He says, our ancient English brethren also considered the pentagram to be an emblem of the sun. In the old lectures, they said, the blazing star in the center refers us to that grand luminary, the sun, which enlightens the earth and by its genial influence dispenses blessings to mankind. This is interesting in light of D.K.'s quote concerning the sixth initiate who, you may remember this from last month, who becomes aware of that star which encloses his planetary star. The pentagram plays a central role on the altars of the Rosicrucians. You can see it there. The picture on the right is a blow-up of the one on the left, and you can see the five-pointed star there. This stained glass is from one of their temples. Also, the rose associated with this order is five-pointed with an inner reversed set of five petals. The pentagram has a long history of use in magical ritual. Dr. John Dee, Heinrich Agrippa, Athanasius Kircher, Giordano Bruno, and many others describe the hermetic and Kabbalistic applications of the pentagram in ceremonial ritual use. We have to wonder if John Dee had any idea of the two higher initiations whose symbol he so beautifully depicted. D.K. says, the two initiations called the sixth and seventh take place on the Buddhic and Atmic planes. The five-pointed star blazes forth from within itself, as the esoteric phrase has it, and becomes a seven-pointed star. It descends upon the man and he enters within the flame. Again from Albert Pike, the pentagram carries with it the power of commanding the spirits of the elements and thus cannot be dispensed with. Indeed, in magical rituals, the orientation of the pentagram is considered to be crucial. Eliphas Levi says in his book, Transcendental Magic, let us keep the figure of the five-pointed star always upright, with the topmost triangle pointed to heaven, for it is the seat of wisdom, and if the figure is reversed, perversion and evil will be the result. But this doesn't tell the whole story of the reverse pentagram. For example, when in combination with the equilateral triangle, we have, according to DK, an ancient symbol for the fifth ray lord. He says, not the fifth ray lord, DK. DK says, one symbol that may be found in the archaic records in lieu of his name, that he's describing the fifth ray lord here, is an inverted five-pointed star with a luminous triangle at the center. It will be noted that the points involved in the symbol, number eight, a picture of that peculiar state of consciousness brought about when the mind is seen to be the slayer of the real. Perhaps this really gets to the heart of the difference between the upright and reverse pentagram. Reversed, it is the slayer of the real by accentuating the duality of the lower mind, whereas upright, it has the potential to slay the slayer of the real. and thus free us from illusion. But since the reverse pentagram is universally seen as representing evil, let's talk for a moment about the idea of the dark forces. DK often uses the term so-called evil, explaining that evil is simply that which seeks to use the potencies within the world of form to become dominant in that world, and in so doing, obscures the causal or spiritual realms. A quote from Letters on Occult Meditation elaborates on this idea. Could we get a reader for this section?
I don't see any hands yet. There we go. Please go ahead, Luca.
Hi, Luca.
Okay. The power of the Dark Brotherhood is apparently dominant on the physical and emotional planes. Not so on the mental, the plane on which the Brothers of the Light work. Mighty dark magicians may be located on the lower mental levels, but on the higher, the White Lodge dominates, the three higher subplanes being the levels that they beg the evolving sons of men to seek. It is their region to which all must strive and aspire.
So, the two upper pointing points of the inverted pentagram could be seen as placing a priority on the duality that rules the lower quaternary, that is, all those subplanes below the third subplane that he mentions, just as the upright pentagram accentuates the spiritual aspect. These two pentagrams, or pentagram orientations, have their counterparts in the Capricorn, Unicorn, and Goat. DK says, Capricorn portrays to us the triumphant initiate, the unicorn of God, the symbol of the unicorn with its one horn outthrust like a single spear upon his brow instead of the two horns of the scavenging goat. The scavenging goat can be seen simply as the personality seeking experience in the lower quaternary. He goes on to say, we have the symbolism of the unicorn in which the two horns and the single eye are blended and depicted by the long straight horn of the unicorn in the center of the forehead. One of the most evocative descriptions of the occult powers of the five-pointed star comes to us from Eliphas Levi's book, Transcendental Magic. And I'd like if we could get a volunteer reader for this section. Anybody like to read? Please raise your hand.
Please go ahead, Guadalupe. We can't hear you.
Are you on self-mute?
That's okay. Is that okay now?
Yes.
Yes.
The pentagram expresses the mind's domination over the elements, and it is by this sign that we bind the demons of the air, the spirits of the fire, the specters of water, and the ghost of earth. It is the star of the Magi, the burning star of the Gnostic schools, the sign of intellectual omnipotence in our autocracy. It is complete comprehension is the key of two words. It is absolute natural philosophy and natural science. Its use, however, is most dangerous to operators who do not complete and perfectly understand it. All mysteries of magic, all symbols of the Gnosis, are figures of occultism. All Kabbalistic keys of prophecy are resumed in the sign of the pentagram, which Paracelsus proclaims to be the greatest and the most potent of all.
Thank you, Guadalupe.
You're welcome.
Yeah, his statement, the pentagram expresses the mind's domination over the elements, suggests the mastery of a fifth initiate. Thus, we might conclude that the power of the pentagram is only as strong That's the degree to which it has been incorporated into the consciousness of the magician. You know, just drawing a circle around you and scribing a pentagram and imagining somehow that this is going to allow you to invoke these elemental powers is nothing short of foolhardy. It requires incorporation of the great consciousness that the symbol represents. So the injunction not to use the pentagram to, quote, bind the demons of the air, etc., without, quote, complete and perfect understanding, refers to a mastery that can only come through initiation. Whether Levi was aware of this or not is unclear. For one would be entering into the most dangerous of all possible practices, unless complete self-forgetfulness, harmlessness, right intent, and the sanction and authority of a master were guiding one's purpose. Levi continues in a more esoteric vein. Could we get another reader for this additional section in his book?
Please go ahead, Yvonne.
This absolute sign, this sign as old or older than history, should and must exercise an incalculable influence on souls disengaged from their material envelope. Armed therewith and suitably disposed, we can behold infinity through the medium of that faculty which is as the soul's eye, and can cause ourselves to be served by legions of angels and demon hordes. The empire of the will over the astral light, which is the physical soul of the four elements, is represented in magic by the pentagram.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Well, I, for one, am not too excited about being served by hordes of demons. And again, the danger of death, poor Mickey here, you know, would be but a trifle compared to the danger of attempting to gain authority over the, quote, legions of angels and demon hordes without a righteous purpose guided by the sanction and authority of one's master. Still, when we look past Levi's seeming fascination with controlling the elementals, we have some insight expressed in his words, we can behold infinity through the medium of that faculty which is as the soul's eye. That faculty, I would guess, is the Ajna Center, facilitated by the consciousness of the five-pointed star. Okay, closely related to its use in magic is the pentagram's effectiveness as a protective talisman, colorfully illustrated in this exchange between Faust and Mephistopheles. The wizard foot, or Drudenfuss, referred to in this passage, is a pentagram. So could I get a volunteer to read this dialogue with me? I'll take the part of Mephistopheles. Wouldn't want to cast any of you into the netherworlds here. So who would like to be Faust? Anybody willing to make the plunge here?
Not so far. There we go. The intrepid Scott, please go ahead.
All right. This is archetypal. Okay. I must confess my step.
Just a second. The white star on my screen obscures half the text. Can that be taken off?
My Lord, how did that happen? Goodness. Okay. Have to do a little surgery here, folks. This is... how about now?
There we go.
Okay. I made the mistake of updating to the latest version of Keynote, and obviously there's still some bugs in it. When I'm in full screen mode, we get that whiteness. So we'll just go through that. So far, that's the only problem we've had. Okay. I must confess my stepping o'er thy threshold, a slight hindrance doth impede. The wizard foot doth me retain.
The pentagram thy peace doth mar? To me, thou son of hell, explain, how camest thou in, if this thine exit bar? Should such a spirit aught ensnare? Could such a spirit aught ensnare?
Observe it well. It is not drawn with care. One of the angles, that which points without, is, as thou seest, not quite closed. Okay, thank you for that. Nothing like a little drama in our lives. All right, see if we can move past there. Okay, hopefully that won't happen again with the white field. Okay, this exchange may seem somewhat fanciful, but DK states the following concerning members of the new group of world servers who are preparing for the manifestation of the hierarchy. Quote, they must walk clear-eyed through world difficulties and, holding his five-pointed star before them, pass unscathed and successful through the midst of all frustrating factors. Okay, since this passage, in this passage, the H in his is capitalized, and since the statement appears in a section entitled Preparation for the Reappearance of the Christ, we can assume the five-pointed star talisman that the ardent server is to hold before him is that of the Christ. Not at all surprising, since every master becomes the five-pointed star, and the Christ is the master of masters. Of course, holding his five-pointed star before them is a visualization and is thus a way of invoking his protection. So, we've determined that the five-pointed star is both powerful and sacred. It can be no coincidence that these qualities, at least in part, are due to the ubiquitous presence of the golden ratio within the pentagram. You may remember from last time that we showed the phi relationships within the structure of the pentagram. So let's take a look at this figure using DK's three-part analysis. This figure, not the pentagram, which is the golden spiral. So could we get a reader for this very familiar by now instruction? However, I don't think it's in any way a problem to continually repeat this. I'd like to impress this on all our minds. So could we get a reader for this short passage?
Please go ahead, Clesia.
Exoterically, this involves study of its form as a whole and of its lines, and therefore of its numerical significance, and also study of its sectional forms, by which I mean its arrangements.
Thank you, Clitia. Appreciate that. So, what can we say about the lines, the numerical significance, and the arrangement of forms that make up this golden ratio spiral? At this point, we're not looking for meaning or significance, but rather for a tabulation of this figure's physical attributes. As we make our mental list, we'd love to have you participate. When called on, please briefly describe a single physical attribute of this symbol. Your observations may seem obvious, like the ones listed here. That's fine. Any ideas that help us physically define this figure are useful, even the most obvious ideas. So I'll start the list off with two ideas. The single line of the spiral is logarithmically curvilinear. And second, the rectangles chart the golden ratio expressed by the spiral. So, any further observations? What other physical attributes do you see? Any thoughts about the physical qualities? It could be quite simple, if you'd like.
Here we go. Oops. Right, please go ahead, Terry.
There's 90-degree angle. There's 90-degree angles there, four of them. And more than that, because there's a square inside as well, so there's three more there.
Yeah, it's actually an infinite...
Seven.
Yeah, seven depicted, and an infinite number if we were to able to travel further in. It's just the resolution of the picture prevents that. If we could look at it on a billboard, we may be able to go in another seven, but it's an infinite series in both directions. Anyway, thanks, Terry. Yes, it is a series of 90-degree angles, which define the rectangles. Any other observations about the physical qualities of this golden spiral?
Malia, please go ahead.
As I look at the squares that spiral curves around, each of the squares is related in size proportionately to the square that preceded it. As you're going around clockwise. So, and it looks to me as though each of them is the ratio of the golden mean to each other.
That's correct. That is indeed the case. It's a continuous relationship. That is, the second biggest square is in a golden mean relationship to the biggest, third biggest square, in a golden mean relationship to the second, et cetera. So, yeah, that's a keen observation. Thank you. Any other observations?
We have a couple of typed. From Anne, it parts every square into two parts. And from Helen, every segment has the same curvature.
Mm-hmm. That's both of those are true, right. And related. So, any other ideas?
Please go ahead, Luca. You're on self-mute. You're still on self-mute. There you go.
It's okay. The whole plane is covered. If you expand this into infinitude, then the infinite plane would be covered by these squares.
Yes, so, indeed. You could say that all of existence, yes, if you were to continue this spiral in both directions, you would cover both the infinitesimal and the macrocosmic. Yes, the whole plane is covered by this. Thank you, Luca. Other thoughts? Anyone?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. I must have had myself on mute. From Bibby, it seems to me that every square is the double of the previous one, starting from the center.
It's the double from the previous one. Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And from Anne, I'm sorry, let me unmute Anne. I'm not quite sure. Anne, go ahead, please, and I don't understand your...
Yes, I'm using... I used the Greek word, sorry. Because of the number phi, I think it's the way you say it. It's harmonious. It gives us a sense of harmony.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. In fact, you could say that the golden spiral is the harmonious element within this figure, right? It's the continuous harmonious element. Yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. This evokes the idea of quality, which is a second, fourth, sixth ray concept, right? Or a second second principle concept, that we're looking for quality as well as the essence, our description of the essence. Any other thoughts?
We have several. Go ahead, please, Suzanne.
Oh, good.
Suzanne? We can't hear you. There we go.
There.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, my only thought is that it, to me, it's a dance of life through form, movement through structure, the line versus the curve.
Mm-hmm. That's more of a comment that would go with our subjective quality, but it is even present in the physical description that there's a real opposite juxtaposition of the quality of the spiral compared to the rectangles or squares through which it passes. So, yes, thank you. Other thoughts? And if you can, keep them to physical. Just physical description. You'll get a chance for the subjective in our next part of our analysis.
Hello?
Yes.
It seems that in every square, the arc of the spiral goes to the opposite side and then changes direction and comes to the opposite side of the next square and then changes direction, goes to the opposite side in the arc of the square, changes direction, and this pattern repeats again and again.
Yes, I thought you might continue saying that for the rest of all time, because
yes,
that's what it would take to actually describe what's going on.
Exactly.
That's a very good point. It's ascending, like in the largest square,
and
we have it ascending, and then it is descending. Descending again, ascending. And this is something I didn't notice, which is that it after the first square, it descends through two squares.
And then ascends to three squares.
Through two squares, then descends through two squares, ascends. It's interesting. Well, so it would appear anyway. Yeah. Thank you for that. That's good eye on that. Any other thoughts before we move on?
Yes, we have one more hand, but we also have one more comment. Martin says,
okay,
each square contains a horizon.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. I assume by the horizon you mean the sense of division that's created by the spiral or the curvilinear line. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the other, you're going to call on somebody for the last?
Yes, Terry, and then we got another hand. Please go
all
ahead,
right,
Terry.
No, thank you. Just a note that the nature of the curved line, if continued from the left onwards, would not form a proper circle. So it's not
that's right.
A circle.
Yeah.
Whatever it's doing, it's doing that in its circular form, but not producing a proper circle.
Mm.
It's a use of curved line, but a use of it, not a complete one in circle terms.
Right. It is. The angle of this line would not It changes with every square. We have a redefinition of the angle of the curvilinear line. It would be interesting to take four of the squares to the left, for instance, and piece them together and see what kind of form you would get. Whether it seems that it wouldn't. You're right, Terry, that it wouldn't be circular. That it would be flattened. At the apex on all those. That's a good observation. Okay, any other thoughts?
We have a couple. Please go ahead, Luca.
Here on the picture, there are two ways depicted how the spiral can be drawn, but there is another one with diagonals. And mm-hmm. if you do that, then you have three relationships between the square, the circle, and the line.
When you include the diagonal line.
The diagonal, well, yeah.
Yeah, I have an illustration of that coming up in my description, which is you draw a line diagonally from the upper right corner down to the lower left of the big rectangle, and then you draw another double diagonal line on the second rectangle, which is the rectangle to the right. But I'll show that. Instead of explaining it, I'll show that in an upcoming comment. So thank you for that, Luca. Okay, let's wrap it up. Any other thoughts
This? One more. Okay. Please go ahead, Victor.
One more, and then we'll draw the line there, because just in the interest of time.
Okay. Go ahead, Victor.
All the squares are different sizes. All the curved lines are different. There's none equal.
That's right. Yes, indeed. And that difference is determined, as someone mentioned, by the golden ratio proportion. And we'll get into just what that is in a moment. Thanks, and I'm going to...
One more really quick one from Risa. She says, yeah. Every rectangle is divided by a third.
That's not quite right. It's close to a third, but it's actually a proportion that's determined by a super rational number, which is not precisely one-third. But it's I could see why you would say that to just look at it. But it's actually in a relationship of 6.18. Whereas if it was a third, it would be 0.666. So it's close, but not quite. But thank you for that. It certainly apparently looks to be that way. Okay, we're going to move on. So here's some additional thoughts. Any fragment of the spiral expresses the golden ratio, because the ratio is inherent in the dynamic curve of the spiral itself. The spiral never ends, this was pointed out. It can be extended infinitely in both directions. The golden ratio can be more easily measured when the spiral is delineated by a series of rectangles. And this brings up the question of whether the squares and the rectangles are an intrinsic part of this illustration, or whether they just chart the spiral itself. The spiral certainly could stand on its own as a symbol. And I think in its purest form is just the spiral. But the rectangles and the squares give us so much information that I think it's useful to include them. Okay. The golden ratio is based on the length of the baseline of any one of these rectangles. Okay. And this takes us to the definition of a golden. Oh, here's a further slide on showing more a more detailed explanation. And there's your crosses, Luca. Okay, so here's the actual definition of the golden ratio. The whole length of the line is to the longer length as the longer length is to the shorter length. The reverse is also true. The shorter is to the longer as the longer is to the whole. Now, it's critical that you take a moment and comprehend this, that you really get what's being said here. This is the only place on a line where you can divide it in such a way that the entire line, that includes the blue and the red, is in relationship to the blue line in the same proportional way as the blue line is to the red line, and vice versa. You can go up or down that way. That's what makes this ratio golden. Okay. Here's one way to divide a line so that it expresses the golden ratio. If while centering a compass point at the midpoint of the baseline of a square, we scribe an arc from either upper corner until it intersects the baseline. So we have the square, we have it divided, then we find the corner, and then we scribe the arc. Oops, back there. The total length of the new baseline is phi in relationship to the 1 of the baseline of the square. So do you see the relationship? Now look at just the last illustration there, and the numbers there at the bottom are exactly the same as these. You see? Okay, back to the golden spiral. The enclosing rectangles are alternately horizontal and vertical. When moving toward the center, the long and short sides of these rectangles are in a proportion of phi to 1 to 1 over phi to 1 over phi squared to 1 over phi cubed, etc., going on and on. When moving away from the center, and this isn't illustrated here, the long and short sides are in a proportion of 1 to phi, but then if we were to go bigger than this, it would be to phi squared, to phi cubed, etc. Okay? Drawing a diagonal line from corner to corner through both of the largest horizontal and vertical rectangles locates what's called the eye of the rectangle, which is the pivot point around which an infinite series of successively smaller as well as successively larger rectangles rotate or seem to rotate, though it moves ever closer, the spiral never actually intersects the crossing point of these two diagonal lines. The angle of the golden spiral grows more acute as it approaches the center, but this angle remains the same within the context of any one rectangle. No matter how large or small that rectangle, it's somewhat fractal in that way. Okay, let's talk about ratio for a moment. There are a number of different types of ratios, the simplest being A to B, which is just a simple comparison. But for a ratio to be analogous, it's a Greek term, analogous, we need to add at least one additional element. For example, 2 is to 4, as 3 is to 6. This was called by the Pythagoreans a four-termed discontinuous proportion with an invariant ratio of 1 to 2. Now, before you go screaming out the door, it's just discontinuous because none of the four numbers are the same. But when the middle two numbers are the same, then such as 1 is to 3, as 3 is to 9, we have what the Pythagoreans called a three-termed continuous ratio, written like this. A is to B is to C, or simply A is to B as it is to C. An example of a three-termed ratio, continuous ratio, is 1 to 3 to 9. In these ratios, the second pivotal element is always the square root of the third element. Bear with me. I promise you, that's as technical as we're going to get. Okay? Now, there is only one way to divide a line so that it yields a three-termed continuous ratio. This is what makes the ratio golden. If we make A the whole length, B the longer length, and C the shorter length, A is to B as B is to C expresses the golden ratio. Excuse me. The reason for this proportion is often illustrated through the geometry of a divided line instead of a relationship of two numbers, because no two numbers give us the exact phi proportion. This proportion can only be expressed using what I call super rational numbers, which are also called functions. These super rational functions are known as phi for the smaller proportion and phi for the larger. To my knowledge, there is no function known as pho or fum. For the more mathematically minded among you, here are some variations on these proportions. Notice, don't get put off by, all of the mathematical script going on here. Just notice that unity or one can act as the shorter segment, like it does on the top line, the longer segment, as it does on the middle, or the whole line, as it does on the bottom. And this will be important when we come to our subjective analysis. Hint, hint. Okay. There's lots of ways to find the golden ratio using only a compass and a straight edge. This illustration shows one of these ways. It's one of my favorite because it sets it up on a vertical, which allows for other possibilities. Okay, one of the main purposes of this physical analysis is to stimulate our imaginations with the hope of stimulating our intuitions. So, let's move into the subjective phase of our analysis. Could we get a reader for this section, please? Somebody jump up. Anybody like to read?
Yes, please go ahead, Malia. You're on self-mute. There you go.
Conceptually, this involves arriving at its underlying idea, which may be expressed in its name, at its meaning as that emerges in the consciousness through meditation, and at its significance as a whole or in part. You should, when doing this, bear in mind that the idea connotes the higher or abstract intent, that the meaning is that intent expressed in terms of the concrete mind, and that its significance has in it more of an emotional quality and might be expressed as the type of desire it arouses in you.
Thank you. Okay, D.K. ascribes meaning to the concrete mind and significance to the emotional realm. So, considering our list of physical attributes, this list only, of course, can include those that I created, but also those that you came up with. Considering this list, what meaning or significance can we ascribe to the golden spiral? You know, often it's a good idea to start with a single physical attribute and try to extend any one of these into its possible subjective meaning. If we had time, literally, we could go through this list one by one and extrapolate the potential subjective implication of the physical quality. So, actually what I'm doing is stalling, giving you a chance to try to think of something here. Let me give you an example. Don't get too freaked out here. This is, since the golden ratio always remains constant, no matter how small or large the rectangles become, it would seem to be an expression of a great cosmic law tying together the essential nature of atoms of substance and of galaxies alike. Thus, the golden ratio is a prime candidate for being one of the laws behind as above, so below. So that's an example of a way of looking at this golden ratio subjectively. Do we have any further ideas about the meaning and significance of the golden spiral. As you're thinking about this, you may wish to consider our list of physical attributes. So take your time. Even if we have a moment of silence here, that's perfectly all right. What ideas do you have about the meaning and significance of the golden spiral?
Please go ahead, Malia.
This is building on what you said in the above, and as above, so below. But it is so amazing how often you see the golden ratio curve expressed in the natural world. The nautilus shell is probably the best known, but as someone who's lived where there are fiddlehead ferns, you see it everywhere.
Mm-hmm. This is true. In fact, I'll probably talk for about 20 or 30 minutes on it at our next webinar about the frequency of the astonishing, ubiquitous presence of the golden ratio in nature, including in our own bodies. Yes. Thank you, Malia. Yes. Anyone else?
Yes, we have several. Let me just say quickly, Martin has typed in, the golden ratio illustrates a progression in recognition.
Progression in recognition. That's interesting. Martin, are you willing to actually speak up and talk a bit more about that?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, it has to do with what I said about the horizon earlier, in the sense that each of the squares, if you stand at the right angle of the square and look, you're looking to a retina or a horizon. And what you said earlier was the five-pointed star represents the star of recognition. So I'm putting the two together.
Yes.
As the horizon expands, as each of the rectangles expands, as each of the as the spiral expands. And so we're moving in a progression of self-conscious awareness from, let's say, the human being is self-conscious, the planetary logos is self-conscious, the solar logos is self-conscious. So it's kind of the progression, the chain of conscious evolution, and I could say more.
Yeah, I get it. That's terrific. Wow, I really like that thought. That let's see, let's pull one up here. Here we go. So I think what Martin is saying, and you can correct me if I'm totally wrong here, that as you're standing, say, in the lower left corner, maybe it'd be better to go the other way. Let's go in 1, 2, 3, 4 squares, okay, or 5 squares. So if you're standing at the top of the 5th square in, okay, and you're looking across the arc to the far horizon, it actually, the next square is beyond the horizon. So if you look at this as a discrete unit of consciousness, it's actually has the next level of consciousness is, in a sense, beyond your horizon, right? So you could say that the arc represents the scope of the consciousness of the unit of the jiva, or the unit of consciousness that the square represents. Is that even close?
Yes.
No, good. I hate to make up stories, based on something that somebody else says. So good, yeah, I really like that, the idea of seeing it as a horizon line. When you first said it, I was looking like, the curvature of the Earth, and seeing that as the horizon. But now I see, it's a much more profound concept. Yes, that's really terrific. Thank you, Martin. You must always come. If you're going to say comments like that, then you must always be here. Okay, so let's get back here to our list in case you need some inspiration. Okay. Any other comments?
Yes, we have several hands up, but we also have a couple of typed comments. So let me do them really quickly. From Tanya, considering the statement that the spiral is infinite, it reminds her of Buddha's definition of the mind as a continuum without beginning or end.
Indeed. I think there's very, very possibly a direct correlation there. And again, it's the sweep of the spiral itself that suggests that seamless continuum, right? So thank you.
And then Anne says, it gives me the feeling, the breath of God coming down in manifestation, and it's the symbol of the hierarchy.
Yeah, I see the idea of the breath of God. Yes, the great breath, which animates even the tiniest atom of substance, as well as the galaxies and cosmic centers. And as a symbol of the hierarchy, could you say more about that? How do you see it as a symbol of the hierarchy? Or what makes it a symbol of the hierarchy?
I mean the hierarchy of everything. There is a hierarchy. In nature. It's the humanity, and then it's the hierarchy, and then it's Sanat Kumara, and then it goes on, it never finishes. So when you see down, you have written phi is the root of 1 plus plus. It never finishes.
Yes,
the one hits the other and the other, and it never stops. That sense.
Yeah, I get you. And in that sense, I think it's apparent. You know, I thought you meant specifically the hierarchy itself, and I was curious to know what you meant by that. But in terms of that greater sense of the word hierarchy, which is the continuum from an atom of substance to the godlike entities, that is indeed, I think, a perfect symbol for that. So, yes. Other thoughts?
Okay, let's... please go ahead, Van.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
As we mentioned in the physical attribute, the spiral changing direction in every square, the spiral in the square. So we have not just a development of consciousness through the matter, but a defined progression which could be predicted with accuracy.
Yes, it can be predicted with accuracy indeed. That's one of the amazing qualities of it. Great. Other thoughts, other observations?
Please go ahead, Guadalupe.
I see in the first line of the attributes, it says this continuous line. If you follow the continuous line and we talk about the consciousness or spirit, if we see it in the involutionary way, it comes spirit spirals to the center to bring form. And then from the center expanding out is the form expanding consciousness in going towards spirit, and it gets bigger.
It gets bigger. Yeah, it could represent the involutionary and evolutionary path.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. And just to make things more difficult, you can reverse that paradigm, reverse your prejudice towards larger or smaller, and imagine that God is within. Remember that Jwal Kool suggests that we visualize the master within the heart a quarter of an inch tall,
right?
You know, which is really an astonishing exercise. So, you know, one could also imagine that here you are on the outside, you know, represented by the large, and you're moving ever towards the center of the truth or reality, which is, in a sense, illustrated by these two diagonal lines, right? That you're getting closer to the truth. But I'm not saying that's, you know, that they're both equally usable. You know, we're not, this is not about a truth, it's about sensing the truth in the symbol. And so you can have both working. Okay, very good. Other thoughts?
Well, I thought I saw a hand up down below, but I don't see it up anymore. But we do have one more comment. Actually, we have several. From Clesia, a magnetic effect of pulling one into the center or pushing away, repulsing, moving away from the center.
Yes, right. Yeah.
And then,
it's almost in that sense like a vortex that pulls us in, you know, like, you know, we could imagine the very center, which is never reached, by the way, like a black hole, you know, which is the, what, event horizon, you could call that. And so in that sense, the greater sweep of the spiral is farthest from that epicenter. So, yes.
And then Jeremy says, the spiral symbolism, the infinite progression of each of the three aspects of deity in its form, consciousness and spiritual aspects, or light, love, and life.
Interesting. Jeremy, could you elucidate a little bit? That's very provocative. And what could you say more about that? Jeremy, we're not hearing you.
It's very abstract, but the spiral, the evolution of it, the spiral is seen in farm life. You know, the Nautilus, and you know the
right.
All the way up to spiral galaxies, which, but it's also, as has been pointed out, is seen in the expanding consciousness of the great chain of being, and which is the conscious point of part of deity, and then there's deity itself, or the life aspect.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's interesting when you plug those three ideas, you know, to the relationship of A is to B as B is to C. And if you contemplate this idea, and I'm going to be exploring this, of what you just brought up, the idea of deity, consciousness, and form, representing those three aspects of the phi golden ratio. So thank you for that. Yes. Other thoughts? Any more?
Please go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, I think the important point, one of them here is, as you keep pointing out, is that you never reach the center. You never reach the original point. What you're dealing with here is like the rootless root of the causeless cause. Out of the infinite, out of the zero, definable forms and lines emerge. How does that happen? That's like a magical progression here, that from something where they never meet.
Yes. You could say that, or you could say that it's the point where the meeting is always taking place, because you, very much like the center of the God is a circle whose center is everywhere and circumference nowhere, that you could see this in that light too, that the center of this spiral is not a loci or a place in space, but it's the very nature of life itself. Which means that if you're trying to depict it in form, that form is particularly accurate as a symbol if it's unable to resolve to that indefinable point, which is pure spirit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Is that when we get to Fibonacci, it's this move from zero to one.
That's it. It is.
That's where you're going into here. This is a...
That's exactly right. Yeah, you're going to the zero point, and appropriately, you can't, you know, it's enticing, right? You imagine that if you like could get in a space capsule and go flying down into these rectangles, that eventually you get to the point. But what you would see is exactly what you're seeing now. It never changes, right? It's the scale changes, but one wonders even about that. What is the relevance of scale to this concept? You know, if the laws are absolute, no matter what the scale, in some ways, the scale itself becomes irrelevant.
Yeah, it's not about scale, it's about what's going on here, and that's consciousness, evolution of time and consciousness. And that's what you're tracing, and the sizes don't matter.
Yeah. I wish I could quote Krishna's great comment. It's something, oh man, am I really going to try this? You know, having pervaded the universe, with a fragment of myself, I remain, something like that. Mm-hmm. I still remain. The idea that the fragment and the universe within his consciousness is one, right? And this could be an apt description of the symbol, you know. Thank you.
Okay, it looks like we have one more.
Okay.
Please go ahead, Suzanne.
Thank you. In reference to your last comment, I like to think that fractaling is related to that comment. The essence of the fractal is pervading the universe. I remain no matter what the fragment. And back to the spiral within the rectangles. As I look at your diagram, I again am reminded, and I'm sorry, I hope I'm in the proper place now subjectively, reminded of the dance of life, the need for life to unfurl, but always to have a place to unfurl. The square and the rectangle remind me of the four square, the place always to manifest spirit.
Hmm. Yes, indeed. Right, it really is form and spirit in a dance, and it beautifully describes that, you know, two opposite essences, you know, well described. And in that sense, actually, that really convinces me that that the rectangles do belong as part of the diagram. When you want to describe that polarity, then, you know, you need the presence of the rectangles and the squares. So thank you.
Even looking at the symbology of the plus one, no matter how many times spirit manifests, no matter how many times, there's always going to be another plus one.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Yeah. That's the very nature of manifestation, which, by the way, is what Phi is all about, as we'll discover next month, that Phi is intrinsic to manifestation. It's absolutely astonishing how ubiquitous it is in the natural world. So, yes. Other thoughts, comments on the subjective qualities of this figure?
We have two more comments. Guadalupe says, the center is not defined, as in ancient times, the Tao that is defined is not the Tao.
Mm.
And then Anne says, it's musical. Every turn is a new musical key.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, there's when you relate the evolution of sound as it's expressed as music through the form world, you know, eventually you get to the harmony of the spheres, which is, you know, something that we can't hear with our ears, but that would represent, you know, depending on your paradigm, either one of the tiny inner squares or the largest outer square of this. Yeah, I like that idea. And it also sort of shows us that we can use it as a template for any kind of progression of concept, right? Such as the progression of musical excellence, or not excellence so much as consciousness as it is portrayed through music. Okay, it, you could look at it as the, yeah.
We got one more comment from Van.
Okay.
He says, it is a symbol of the breathing forth, the sound by the central point, and the symbol of absorbing it.
Say that. Read it again.
Okay. It is a symbol of the breathing forth, the sound by the central point, and the symbol of absorbing it.
Yeah, that's beautifully written. Beautifully. Beautifully said. Thank you, Van. Okay. Because we're believe it or not, we only have 15 minutes left, I'm going to move on at this point. And describe some of my thoughts. I'm struck with the subjective similarity between gazing into the infinite center of the golden spiral as though it were a tunnel receding into the distance, and the phi formula that we looked at last month, you know, down at the bottom there, which also seems to stretch into infinite distance. Both, of course, represent the same golden ratio phenomena. It's as though size and distance have become interchangeable. From one point of view, there are no rectangles, only squares whose diagonal corners are connected by an arc. The arc links, sizes, and orients the squares it successively passes through into a series of interrelated and interconnected forms. So not only does it define the consciousness of the square that it's passing through, but it also links, sizes, and orients the squares that are both succeeded and are before it. It's as though the squares represent nested units of substance linked by the consciousness aspect, represented by the golden spiral, and the ephemeral rectangle becomes that which carries them forward towards greater union with the one life, the life of Phi. Hey, we should make a movie. Okay, developing this idea a bit further, the most important element in the A to B as B is to C seems to be the central one, the one that links A to C. Perhaps this is truly the function of unity, not as a quantity, but as that which, through inclusivity, unifies. In our solar system, this central linking element is the energy of the second ray. To develop this idea further, the first ray represents the Godhead, the sum total. The third ray represents the visible and invisible formed nature. And the second ray, or second principle, that which unites the two. For humanity, that central element is the soul, which links the monad and the personality. Now, when we overlay the chart of the cosmic physical plane, we find that the point of division of the golden ratio, the point that divides the second and third principles, just so happens to occur on the third subplane of the mental plane, on the subplane of the ego and causal body. You can imagine my glee when I discovered this. This is either an amazing coincidence or a systemic level example of the influence of the golden ratio. Okay, if we pay attention to what this great ratio has to teach us, we see that the linking or B principle is not unique to the soul, because all units of consciousness are, in relation to some other unit of consciousness, the linking or B principle. So though, for example, we generally view the personality as the short line or C element, to the tiny lives that the personality organizes, that personality is the linking principle. Thus, all discrete units of consciousness, whether a galaxy or an atom of substance, are at the same time A, the whole, B, the linking element, and C, the lesser receptive unit, seeking to become one with the greater. Nothing stands alone. All is connected. And if somebody asks you for proof, why, just show them this diagram. All right, I'd guess that when the initiate becomes the five-pointed star and thus comes face to face with that radiant something, substanding the law of phi, there comes upon him or her a profound understanding of this triple interlinked identity. No wonder that Plato, through whose writings much of the Pythagorean tradition survived, considered the three-termed continuous geometric proportion, which is what we're talking about with A, B, and C, remember, to be a sacred reality. He tells us in Timaeus that what he calls the world's soul binds together in harmonic resonance the causal realm of ideas and the visible world of objects through two hierarchies of continuous geometric proportion, which he called the lambda. Both of these hierarchies originating in the one, or world soul, that's represented there at the top of that inverted V. He considered the 2, 4, 8, 16 line to be feminine and the 3, 9, 27 line to be the masculine expression of this energy that binds spirit to matter. This brings to mind the human and deva evolutions with the divine hermaphrodite unifying the two streams at the top point. We have to remember that Plato was bound by a code of secrecy and much could only be inferred. The golden mean itself was, we are speculating, because of any the lack of any writings that particularly describe it. So we figure that the golden mean itself was one of these secrets. And Plato only hinted at its existence by instructing his students to divide a line unequally. Possibly he hoped they would realize that there is only one way to divide a line in such a way that it will yield a continuous geometric proportion and thus come to an awareness of the golden ratio through their own experimentation. Then again, we stare at some things for years without realizing just what we're really looking at. Okay, we're going to finish today's session with the final stage of our analysis. Can we get a reader for this esoteric section of our three-phase analysis? Gee, I wonder if we could apply A, B, and C to the analysis themselves. Ooh, I like that. Of course we can. You know, the this would be the they're lettered backwards in a sense. This would be the A stage, the whole, right? And the subjective phase would be the linking phase, the middle, the subjective. And the first phase we considered would be the exoteric or C phase, just to totally confuse you. Okay. Do we have a reader?
Yes, we do. Please go ahead, Walter.
Yes. C, esoterically, this would cover the effect of the force or energy upon you and of the quality of the vibration it may arouse in you, perhaps in some center, perhaps in your astral body, or perhaps only in your mind.
Thanks, Walter. Okay, having familiarized ourselves with the golden spiral, let's seize the moment and reflect on where in ourselves it affects us. Q, keep in mind as you visualize that symbols and geometric figures, rather than being descriptions of potencies, are inherently potent. Thus, they have the potential to penetrate and reveal. So we'll take exactly 1 minute for this meditation, starting now. Okay. I'm sure that we could talk for another 30 minutes on just what we just visualized. It's one of the really fabulous symbols. And I thank you. I think we did a really good job together in analyzing the symbol. That's it for today. I hope you've enjoyed the webinar. Next month, we'll continue our survey, the number 5, by exploring the Fibonacci sequence, the fifth ray, the color orange, the Hierophant Arcanum in the Tarot, Gebra, the fifth Sephiroth in the Tree of Life, and other aspects of the number 5. Okay, the reading list remains the same, except for the addition of a section in Robert Lawler's Sacred Geometry, page 44 to 66. This includes a fabulous series of drawings, drawing exercises on the golden ratio. And by the way, you don't have to own this book. A PDF version of this of Sacred Geometry can be found for free online. Just do a Google search, and at least for me, it came right up. But if you can afford it, this should be one of the cornerstones of your Sacred Geometry library if you're so inclined to create such a library, because it's really one of the great books, just a little bit over 100 pages, but it's just one of the really great books. And this section is particularly terrific. Okay, for today's meditation, I'd like to lead you in a guided visualization using stanza 5 from the stanzas of Zan in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. See if you can pick up on the three-termed continuous ratio that seems to be expressed in this stanza. We'll start and end with an om. The Lords of Flame arose and prepared themselves. It was decision's hour. The seven lords of the seven spheres watched breathless the result. The great lord of Sphere the Fourth awaited the oncoming. The lower was prepared, the upper was resigned. The great five waited for the point of equidistant merging. The foundation note ascended, deep, answered unto deep. The fivefold chord awaited the response from those whose hour had come. Dark grew the space between the spheres. Radiant, two balls became. the threefold 35, finding the distance just, flashed like a sheet of intermittent flame, and lo, the work was done. The great five met the three and four. The point intermediate was achieved. The hour of sacrifice, the sacrifice of flame, arrived, and for eons hath endured. The timeless ones entered into time. The watchers began their task, and lo, the work proceeds. Okay, that's it for today. Don't forget to donate a couple of bucks to the Moria Federation on moriafederation.com, which will help pay the yearly fee for this GoToMeeting account that makes these webinars possible. Thanks to Brett. These webinars are available on makara.us, so you can recommend them to your friends, and maybe they'll show up for the live version. And thanks again, BL, for your assistance. Couldn't do this without you. So keep spreading the word, and thank you so much for attending. Our next webinar, always on the third Sunday, will be on August 16th, less than a month. Okay. Bye for now.
Bye, everybody.